Obviously, key initiative is to use technology for the empowerment of the business. That's to deliver our software faster, to secure our environments, to make people a lot more productive in their roles. Again, the idea is we don't view technology as a cost center. We view it as a technology enablement of the business.
Welcome to the Disruptive Innovators, Champions of Digital Business podcast, where IT and digital leaders from around the world talk about their careers, their inspiration, and their vision for the future of digital business. I'm your host, David Wright. The world of digital business is evolving faster than ever, and I want this to be a place where digital business champions create a village to band together and help each other navigate the ever-changing terrain. Disruptive Innovators features conversations with CIOs and digital leaders from around the world, diving into their personal backstory, career, their current role, trends they've been seeing, and their vision for the future, personally, professionally, and otherwise. This podcast is made for people who are seeing how quickly the digital business landscape is evolving, those who recognize that it takes a village of trusted advisors to navigate this ever-changing terrain, people who enjoy listening to high-level discussions surrounding what it means to be a leader, real-world examples of challenges faced, and industry-specific strategies leveraged to create exceptional business outcomes. This episode is brought to you by Disruptive Innovations, a leading tech consulting firm that helps enterprise organizations with their IT strategy, process optimization, and workflow improvement. Contact them and find out more at disruptiveinnovations.net.
Good afternoon, innovators. David Wright here, and I'm your host of the Disruptive Innovators Champions of Digital Business podcast. It's a mouthful. Today, I am joined by Jason James, aka JJ. It's a pleasure to have you on, my friend. How's it going?
Good. Thank you for having me today.
Yeah, absolutely. I know it's been a long time in the making. JJ, for those of our listeners who might not be familiar with you or where you are today, could you just tell everyone a little bit about your current role?
Sure. So as Chief Information Officer of Aptos, I oversee all of our digital transformation. I lead our cloud enablement team. I lead our DevOps. I lead our internal IT business systems and cybersecurity compliance. So Aptos is the largest software company dedicated purely to retail. So if you go in the mall, it's many of the stores you run into: New Balance, Michael Kors, Tommy Bahama, Boot Barn, so on and so forth. Easiest way to think about it, we supply the point of sale order management CRM to most major retailers. So if you're in the mall, it's everybody really but the anchor stores.
Wow. Crazy to even think about. And I'm excited to learn more about what you guys are up to, especially given all the technological advancements in the last year or so, even though AI has been around a while. But anyway, before anything, JJ, I'd just like to start the episode first and foremost with one piece of actionable advice you might look to leave everyone with today.
Just in general. So I'm a big proponent of mentoring. I'm a big proponent of creating the next generation of leaders. And if I can inspire anybody out there, it's what are you doing to create the next generation of leaders? If you think about all the digital transformation you do, you think about all the projects, all this innovation, people won't remember that. They'll remember what you did for their career. They'll remember how you helped them.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true. Like the impact that you're having on the lives of people, I think that carries through for me too, to just the mission or vision of what I'm doing for an organization versus just like a technology initiative itself. Because it is, at the end of the day, about the people still. Yeah, great. Great way to start the episode. Before we get into the work that you guys are up to at Aptos, JJ, I'd just like to start learning a little bit more about your backstory. I know you're involved with Forbes. You've had a lot of amazing posts over your career. Where did you start out and how did you get to the point that you're at in your career today?
Yeah, I've been fortunate. I've lived and worked in Atlanta. I grew up a couple hours south of here in Alabama. I've always worked in technology. I grew up in a time where, if you've ever seen Norma Rae, that was filmed in my town. I was first generation. Either side of my family never worked in a cotton mill. So at 15, when people had summer jobs, mowing lawns, working in grocery stores, working in the cotton mill. I was laying out Lantastic networks and doing PC upgrades. I've always worked in technology. When I started my academic career at Auburn University, I worked for a value-added reseller. 2 years later, I actually bought it. So I've always been entrepreneurial driven. I took a sabbatical because I was working 70, 80 hours a week. And at the time, they did not embrace non-traditional students. So I did that. Company out of Birmingham, bought it a year later. I moved to Atlanta. I've been here almost 25 years. In fact, January 1st will be 25 years. And I did several startups, but I come from the infrastructure side of the house. So dealing with data centers, dealing with cloud computing, dealing with SaaS, I've worked in everything from retail, even prior to this, to healthcare tech. I've been CIO across two healthcare tech companies. I've worked in telecom. I've worked in a division of financial services, but it's all been on the tech side. It's all been infrastructure driven, but because I had such a strong entrepreneurial background, I just happened to be a technologist that could understand EBITDA and could understand earnings and the growth of the business and how to take technology and empower the business, not just be a cost center.
Yeah. And I'm interested to digging into that a little more, because I think that's something that some technologists and CIOs can struggle with, like really working the muscle that you're talking about there. In addition to, from a leadership perspective, how am I connecting, mentoring, inspiring versus managing? But what would you say, JJ, is one of the most important things that you learned over the course of your journey? Or was there a time that either you had a project fail or you had a personal event, but ultimately you took away a really profound lesson?
Yeah, I think that we all have projects that fail. It's how you handle them. Number one, when stuff starts going off the rails, you can't wait till the 11th hour to notify stakeholders or management. You have to be upfront. It's, as a leader, you don't always have to be right, but you have to be seen. And you have to be the one that's in charge. And you have to be the one that takes the credit for the failure and not take credit for the success. And I think in learning that, you realize that's what helps define your legacy. That's what helps define your leadership style, is the idea is you're there to provide that air cover for your team. You're there to provide the support, but you're also there to take the bullets. When things happen, be ready to do that. And again, it goes back to that whole importance of mentoring and how people will remember what you did and not necessarily the tech projects that you helped lead.
Yeah. You said a lot of really valuable stuff there. The first that really sticks out to me is that communication, right? Proactive. I don't want to say over communicate because it has almost like a negative connotation. But at the same time, like one of the things I love about like Delta Airlines is that they communicate well. When things are delayed, when, you know, I had an incident a number of months ago where they grounded all the planes out of New York. I got an email at 2 a.m. I had to be in Akron the next day, and I got in a car and I drove to Akron, and I wouldn't have been able to do that hadn't I gotten that alert at that time of morning. And so that's all just to say that even if it's something that's unfortunate, over communicating makes it so that it's not as much on that entity, right, as it is just the situation that we're facing together. And I
think that's the key, David. Sorry. Yeah. I think that's the key, is that you're in it together. I think one of the things that people have come to have almost an understanding is things can go wrong. What they expect is, as things go wrong, are they up to speed? Do they know? Is it a shared experience versus you've literally gotten to the airport, you're sitting there and all the flights are canceled. And you knew about this 4 hours ago. Why am I just finding about it now? And creating that sort of shared experience and realizing that it's not just you, it's how it's impacting others, and that level of professional empathy and just empathy in general, I think is so critical to leadership, especially when things aren't going well.
100%. And the other thing that what you said makes me think about is basically Hold on, I have to restart that. I like lost my train of thought. And this is fully edited. It's such a good anecdote. We're talking about, what was the last thing you just were talking about, JJ?
The fact of a collective shared experience and being proactive in it, because I think people understand that issues occur. What they don't understand is failing to communicate, especially in a world where communication is so easy. We have instant message, we have text, we have ways of getting it out. I'm not sending you a telegram, for God's sake, David. There's no reason why I shouldn't over communicate.
Right. Oh, man. Maybe it'll come back to me. Such a shame. And the original advice that you had said in so many words before we went on the prior tangent, like about the project failing or something like that, was, can you just repeat that bit?
Just that people expect that projects can fail. What they don't expect is not to be included. The idea is that we all have a shared experience. We're all part of this shared collective. And it's important that they share sometimes not only the successes, but share the failures. There was an interesting story I read the other day that a Japanese bullet train sent an apology note because they left 20 seconds early. And they didn't want to negatively impact them on 20 seconds. We would never even know. But the idea is, because we're all in this shared experience together, it's important that people share in that. And sometimes that means sharing bad news.
Yes, exactly. And this is, so basically, Jay, I couldn't agree more. And team, we'll start from this point. Jay, absolutely. And the second thing that makes me think of is, okay, as a leader, why am I hesitant to communicate? And in my experience, it's fear. It's fear-based. My inability to act is either, it could be a thousand forms of fear, but like basically fear of what's to come, fear of losing what I have. And as a leader, I've had to get really comfortable being uncomfortable, really stepping into that discomfort. And now that it's a practiced behavior, it's not as uncomfortable. But there was something, there was some work that I had to do to practice that. But I think, or I should say, I know that I'm better off, my customers are better off, my colleagues are better off, and that people really, it's never as bad as I catastrophized.
Right.
You know?
I think that's a point. It's never as bad as you think it will be. The idea is that, again, everybody's used to issues occurring. There's no major cloud provider that hasn't been impacted in the last, you know, year. There's no such thing as, in most industries, a guaranteed 100% uptime. The idea is things can go wrong, and people expect that if they go wrong and you know about it, have you shared that with them? How can they minimize the risk? How can they be updated? How can they be part of it? It doesn't make you weak as a leader when things happen. Things will always happen. But if you think about any form of politics, it almost seems like you're going from one disaster to the next. It's how you handle that communication. It's how you handle your constituents, so to speak.
Yeah. There's been guys and gals I've had on the podcast, titans of industry that have built and sold businesses and are at the pinnacle of being a technologist as CIOs at worldwide brands like yourself. But the ones that I respect the most are the ones that have been vulnerable about the fact that, yeah, things don't always go well. It's about how you're showing up. It's about how you're, you know, being there for your team, how your kind of level of professional empathy, communication. Yeah, I mean, you nailed it. Is there any other best practices that come to mind or lessons learned that you'd want to, you know, showcase while we got you?
Yeah, I think no matter what is, you know, when we talk about the office of CIO, it's about managing people, process, and technology. By the way, in that order, the tech isn't always the most important. We often, you know, get attracted to the next shiny thing. But at the end of the day, it's about the people, right? They're the ones using it. For right now, I can honestly foresee in the next 4 or 5 years, a portion of our workforce being non-human, whether it be robotic or some form of software bots or whatever. But right now, we're still focused on the support delivery of the needs of people. And as a result, that's how you have to select what you choose. There's plenty of software options in most fields and most industries. Hopefully you're not making your selection in a vacuum. If the people using those tools should be part of your selection process. They should be part of your requirements process. Again, any form of tech leadership, focusing on people first. The tech is part of it, and it's a major part of it, but it's not the most important part of your job.
100%. There's been so many times where we've been brought in after an organization has taken their old tech, kind of unplugged it, and tried to just plug it into a new platform without addressing people, process, methodology. And it's been what it's been. Maybe it was better than what they had. But if you're not addressing or enrolling the underlying stakeholders, yeah, you're in for a rude awakening.
Well, that's why so many digital transformation projects fail. The most successful digital transformations are cultural transformation. And the only way you can change culture is through people. And so it doesn't, by the way, culture isn't born at the top. That helps enforce it. But what happens is, how do you build those advocates in the business? How do you build those stakeholders that want the change to happen, can drive the change to happen within their own departments and become advocates to the office of CIO?
Yeah, 100%. And I tell people when they ask me about this, they're like, how do you go about it? And my experience has been that it's a very grassroots thing. Depending on the size of the organization, we could have upwards of 100 initial conversations and deep dives just with various stakeholders across an organization to get them enrolled in what we're doing. But I'll tell you, spending that 30 to 40 minutes or whatever it is, an hour with that individual, and even if the conversation is largely like anecdotal or qualitative in nature, down the line, when it comes time to call on that person, they know what we're doing. We spent the time to make them feel heard and seen. And it makes all the difference having that person as a champion versus a detractor once we start to actually choose solutions.
And what's funny about that, David, often people will talk about the needs, especially in leadership, of soft skills. And I'm like, what are you talking about? It's just table stakes at this point. It's at what point do you not have empathy for another individual? At what point do you not understand that what we're designed for are humans? We're not developing just for the pure process at all. And it's always interesting to me, and I hear these thought leaders, so to speak, or these pundits talk about all the time the importance of developing soft skills. And at this point, I don't know, it just feels like these are all table stakes, that it's something you have to do, not something you build. And I'm sure it's taught or learned, but at the same time, it's like, it's just baseline requirement for leadership.
Yeah. Let's shift gears a little bit, JJ, and talk a little bit more about your current body of work. Actually, before we do, I just like to ask, favorite book or literary piece that you're either reading or have read currently that you're really enjoying, or all time, your choice?
Oh, man. I read a lot. It's interesting. A lot of tech leaders talk about the importance of reading business books, and there's some I read. But I will also go back and read literature. And I'm a big proponent of leaders making sure they understand the importance of storytelling and the impact of storytelling, because it's how people connect, especially if you can take something very technical and break it down into the story where they learn to understand and they know the why. The how is not always important. The why are we doing something is the most important. But if you think about stories and think about storytelling, it's important to study stories. And every few years, I'll go back and reread To Kill a Mockingbird. And so this time, I didn't reread it. I've been listening to it on audio, and it's beautifully narrated by the actress Sissy Spacek. And to think about how relevant that story is even today, you think about, not yet political, but you've got different parts of America wanting to ban books because certain books make people uncomfortable. And that's the point of it all. It should make you uncomfortable. But to go back and listen to a story as being told through the eyes of a child dealing with incredibly tumultuous, political moments, being seen through the eyes of Scout, which is a girl, and us being fathers of daughters, it's it was interesting listening to it this time. Because the last time I read it, gosh, probably been 20 years, I wasn't a father at the time. And so the perception that I had of listening to it had changed because I had changed. And that's why it's important sometimes, regardless of what story you're drawing, to go back in different moments of time, at different milestones of your life, and go back and listen to it and see what that story resonates and how does it impact you today. And again, that's one that's not exactly what I would call soft literature, meaning your beach kind of book, you're reading it for fun. It's one that is wonderful to read, but it has such large societal ramification. And as someone who grew up in the South, being able to identify those characters, but now seeing it through the eyes of a dad who has young daughters, was just a very different viewpoint. And again, listening to the wonderful Sissy Spacek narrated was pretty impressive too. But that was one I just actually wrapped up this past week.
Wow. I feel like now I'm like compelled to go back and read it again. Cause I can't, for me, it's gotta be the same thing, like 20 years or something.
Oh
like
yeah. And maybe more than that. That's what's sad about it all. And it's just like, I don't know why I was just thinking about, let me go back and read. And there's some, again, I don't always read business books, and I encourage people to look beyond your industry, beyond your sector, even if you do read those books, and just, it helps you learn. I love to read memoirs of very famous people. One I just read recently was Rob Lowe's. And if you think about this guy who was so large in society growing up as part of the Brat Pack, but to hear these stories and hear a person who seems to just not age and have these wonderful stories about everything from classic Hollywood artists like Lucille Ball to, he was dating at one time, I think, the Princess of Monaco. But to hear these larger-than-life stories is important for a leader, because not only do you see that everybody has these different experiences, but to hear him tell these stories and tell them in a way that's also self-deprecating. Because I think when you think about leaders today, they have to be accessible. I think about earlier in my career, I had CEOs that I'd worked for. Sometimes I was second, third in command, and I'd still have to go through their assistant to get on their calendar. And I said, when I was given that mantle, that would never be me. And it never has been. But the idea is that when you think about somebody who is so well known as Rob Lowe, he would still be humble enough to laugh at himself and be self-deprecating. I think it's a really good lesson for all of us, regardless of what rung you land on the ladder, that being humble is still important.
I love that. Yeah, being humble. That's a lesson I learned like really in earnest the number of years back after a personal moment. And it's really made all the difference. You nailed it when you were talking about To Kill a Mockingbird. You mentioned your perspective shifting, having read it prior to being a dad and now being a dad. My experience has been that as a leader, as a business owner, and even as a father, as a human, in the last, call it 5 years, my circumstances have remained largely unchanged. Like I started DI back in 2018 or whatever it was, and we've just been grinding. We had our children, of course, but I don't know, it was like 3 or 4 years ago, I just had this profound perspective shift when it came to fear of failure, when it came to being able to walk through discomfort more readily, accepting that. I don't know what's good or what's bad. What my experience has been is that I have no friggin' idea. Things that I thought were like the worst things ended up spurring some of the biggest growth. Things that I thought were really good maybe hit the wall and then, you know, but then they led to something else. I have no idea. All I can do is the next right thing. And then past that.
Well, I think that's incredibly poignant. I think I was just discussing this with someone recently. I think, first of all, you learn so much more from your failures than you do your successes. Rarely do you step back and you reflect on your successes, but you will your failures. But at the same time, you have to realize as you're going through life and you have these failures and you have these successes that good and bad, that's who made you who you are. And so changing those would have incredible ramifications. successful people never talk about the impact of luck they have on their career, but it does play a role. I'm not saying at any point that you don't have to be prepared. That's the most important. But when you're lucky enough to be given the opportunity, then you have to deliver on it. But sometimes it's luck. It's luck that I met my wife, and it would have never happened. There was all these little things that could have happened along the way that ensured I didn't go to that location that day where we're introduced. I'm not saying it's kismet or destiny or anything like that, but there's certain other aspects. There are aspects where when I think about roles I got, it was fortunate or luck or however you want it that somebody said, I'm not interested in that role, but I know somebody would be perfect for it. And did I have to be well prepared when I was given that opportunity? Absolutely. Prime example, I was having brunch with a friend on Sunday, and we were trying to figure out how we had met. And it turns out he was in a coffee shop on 14th Street in Midtown, and two people in front of him were talking about headshots, and they're in the film industry. Mine is a big film industry. And he said, oh, by the way, I'm a photographer. I do photographs. And he could have been like, I'm not going to say anything. I'm not going to do anything. Fast forward 6 or 8 years after that, he would meet me in London as I proposed to my wife at Westminster Abbey to take pictures of that moment because he was living there. And it was only because these weird little moments of luck happen. And when they do happen, you have to be prepared, but you also have to be humble enough to realize some things were incredibly fortunate to happen to you. Just like for some people, things were incredibly unfortunate to happen to them. There are tornadoes that will take out entire neighborhoods, bounce, so to speak, and miss a house. It's incredible luck. Or you see these things where somebody just happens to be, they'll use the term, right place at the right time. And so I think it's important to realize and be humble enough that we were lucky, but at the same time, when luck was given us the opportunity, we were prepared to take it.
Story. So let's talk about this latest stroke of luck or opportunity, if you will, with Aptos. So you're the CIO, clearly overseeing quite a bit, like the what you rattled off at the beginning, a lot of responsibility, a very wide berth. What's your vision for the organization as it's derived from the overall mission or ethos of Aptos, and maybe what are some of the key initiatives you guys are?
Obviously, key initiative is to use technology for the empowerment of the business. That's to deliver our software faster, to secure our environments, to make people a lot more productive in their roles. Again, the idea is we don't view technology as a cost center. We view it as a technology enablement of the business. So much so, I report directly to the CEO. And if you think about the role of a traditional CIO versus a transformational CIO, reporting structure matters. And it varies from industry. Even in manufacturing, even the most progressive manufacturers, they still have a different reporting structure, basically the CFO. I've never had that. In fact, I've never reported CFO. It doesn't mean I don't work very closely with CFOs throughout my career. But when you view technology as something that is a differentiator, it really changes your investment thesis. It changes your strategy. And as a result, your trajectory and growth as an organization. And we're a tech company. We happen to play in the retail space, and we use our technology to deliver the best experience to our customers. And at the same time, we improve our own productivity and our own profit margins.
Yeah. I was at the CEO summit. It was late last year, but McKinsey was showing their graph of like companies that are really doubling down in technology and the companies that are slow playing it, and the trajectory right now is just becoming so much more stark, or the difference between organizations that are really in seeing technology as a way to drive revenue for the business. I was just talking about this with Greg Myers from Aspen Dental, because he did a bunch of stuff at Terminix that was like, they invested in a platform that cost them $500,000 a year, and it created $20 million a year in revenue. But, and they were able to track that. But I think that it also goes back to like culture. Clearly you have a CEO, and again, you nailed it, where it does take the people, like not just the executive team, but the people in the organization to buy into this as well. But it sounds like to me, like your organization recognizes that IT is a value driver. Now, I guess you would hope that from a software slash like tech
you'd
company.
Hope, right. There are those out there that don't. Right. And even tech companies, which is shocking. And those, to your point, to that McKinsey report, they're laggards because of how they view themselves and how they view. There's a saying that CEOs get the CIO they deserve. And I think this is a prime example where these companies that understand the transformational role of the CIO can also see the transformation in their business. And luckily, our leadership's. And that's why I'm here. Culture matters. Culture is incredibly important. There's a lot of organizations I could go work for, and I chose one that's the right culture and how we view not only our investments, but our most critical investment, and that's our people.
Yeah, no, 100%. And it's funny, you got me thinking when you were talking about maybe tech companies that weren't. One of the largest manufacturers of hardware in the technology world, I'll just leave it at that, reached out to us not too long ago about like totally redoing their knowledge management strategy, because right now it's just like there could be best practices being developed in Asia that like someone in North America has no idea about, and vice versa. There's no way to, and that's just a micro example of the inefficiency, but, and then also like how IT is classically like just over here in a bucket and not fully integrated with kind of the business.
Look, it's funny. You have these tech leaders and being on these national groups and everything. There's always one that pops up and this person will say, I feel like I don't have a seat at the table. And my retort is always, have you earned a seat at the table? It shouldn't be given. It should be earned, and it should be earned every day. And I think those that have a seat at the table have enough political sway to make sure their business drives efficiently and grows because they've looked at technology as an enabler. Yeah, I think, first of all, a modern sort of definition of politics has been skewed by our national view of politics, regardless of party. It's become less what we grew up with and more like the WWE, regardless of department. And I think what it gets down to is the original definition of politics, and it's the management of limited resources. And regardless of where you work, if it's a multi-billion dollar company or it's a startup, you have limited resources. One of your most limited resources is time. And so how do you manage the people, the hard dollar resources, the priorities to make things happen? Much like in a political sense, that means you have to be willing to bend and say, in order to get this, we're going to have to delay this, or we're going to have to get support from this group, knowing that would possibly alienate this group. And so in a political sense, any kind of leadership role is political. What we have to make sure is that we don't take on this sort of political definition of who screams loudest wins. That doesn't work anymore. I think if you think about the evolving cultural landscape of a modern business, it's still politics in the terms if you're trying to manage and grow based on limited resources.
Yep. No, you're absolutely right. Profound stuff, man. Couple last questions I'd have for you, JD. One would be, are there any innovative, exciting projects that you guys are working on that you can share in this kind of forum? Anything that AI is having an impact on or anything like that?
Yeah, so we have three different business units under the Aptos sort of umbrella, if you will. Aptos, with Aptos One being our flagship point of sale system. And so as somebody who has never worked in retail, the ability to quickly grab an iPad and check out someone and return an item was just fascinating for me as a consumer, not the CIO of the company, but as a consumer to go, wow, that's amazing. And then one of our other solutions is Revionics, which does pricing optimization, and what we're doing in terms of artificial intelligence for pricing optimizations. Just incredibly impressive. When you think about dynamic pricing, like you'd see being used at a casino on game nights, incredibly fascinating. And then Ellis Retail out of Iceland and what we're doing in terms of point of sales from everything from retailers and supporting transactions at the Olympics. So it's all super exciting. And it's exciting in a way because I was literally in a retailer recently and I went to check out and I looked down, I was like, wow, that's our point of sale. And I didn't even know that was a client. So it is something to be not only excited, but proud about because we are out there, even though we may not be a household name to non-technology and non-retail centric people, but to know so many people are touching your solutions on a daily basis.
Yeah, no, it is cool when stuff like that happens. Like even I, on a lesser scale or to a lesser extent, like when I'll travel around the country and I'll see like the locations of our clients out in the world, I was like, oh, I didn't know you had a location in Bumble, like middle America, whatever. No, very cool. So retail has evolved, particularly since COVID. You see this, even the most Luddite consumers now using digital channels, retail coming back, right? Of course. But what do you think are some of the biggest opportunities in the retail industry? Or what do you think will be some of the biggest changes as time passes with the understanding that you don't have a crystal ball?
Yeah, but I think number one, it's when you think about the omnichannel experience, is shopping is no longer confined to four walls. Even traditional retailers, if you think about how often people buy online and pick up in store, they don't want to wait, but they also don't want to spend time necessarily because they might have kids or they might be at work or the doctor. They want to be able to quickly go online, buy it, and be like, I'm not waiting for UPS delivered, just going down the mall and I'll pick it up. Or I bought online and it didn't fit, I'm going to return it in stores. And so when you think about this omnichannel experience, that it's no longer confined to just a pure e-commerce play or a pure brick and mortar store, but a hybridization of all of it. And so the idea is your solutions have to be ready when you aren't. And what I mean by that is people are shopping at 2 a.m. Your retail stores aren't open. They want that experience. You have to have, if you're a retailer, you want a hardened system, something that can operate entirely offline. So if you lost Wi-Fi at the mall or a retail location, can you still transact? And so offline is incredibly important for retailers. And it's an exciting time. And when you think about it, we're all consumers. And for us, I have I like to hire people from all different industries. So I'm a big proponent of diversity, and diversity of everything, gender, race, background. Where did these people come from? And when I look at adding talent, I don't go, well, I have to work in retail. I'm like, they've worked in retail, whether they've noticed or not. We're all consumers. And so what I'd much rather have is more diverse background, because it is an industry, while it is incredibly complicated, we have such a strong baseline to begin with, it makes it a lot easier to bring talent up to speed.
Yeah. I just had this conversation with someone the other day about how hiring off of talent. And I talked to my business coach about this too. Like you have to hire someone who can do the job. Like you can't hire someone, like anticipating that they might be able to do the job someday, of course, unless it's like an intern. But I can hire, like you're saying, someone who might not have like a myriad of experience in that specific industry, should they have like certain X factors where it's almost more valuable to have those versus someone that just happens to have worked in that industry.
Yeah, right? I don't want to live in an echo chamber. And so in order to make sure I have a more holistic view, I have to have diversity of thought, diversity of experience. And so with that, I'll take my own background. Prior to the CIO role, I was CIO for two different healthcare tech companies, by the way, in different states. I've lived here in Atlanta, but they were headquartered elsewhere. But with that, it gave me a unique experience coming back into retail because I brought with it what I had seen in terms of next-gen security, because healthcare was always under attack. And retail, from a cybersecurity perspective, is the third most attacked sector. And so what I was able to do was bring in a lot of findings in terms of cybersecurity and next-gen technologies and SaaS performance and bring them into retail. People often think data is unique, and it's not. The penalties for violating that data are unique. HIPAA compliance is very different than PCI, but the solutions I use to protect those aren't any different. The DLP I use have been the same across industries. The firewalls I've used across industries, they're no different. If you're good enough at what you do and you have a passion for learning, you can learn most businesses. I still think technologist and especially the CIO still has to have an incredibly strong technical acumen, but still be a business leader.
Yeah, 100%. Being able to hop across those different aspects of the IT stack that you mentioned when we first started this episode that you're overseeing, and maybe not being a deep expert in each one, but being an expert in a handful of them, having come from that space. And then for those you're maybe not so deep, at least having a really great working knowledge. I've seen organizations that don't have that, and things can crumble really quick because people start working in that vacuum and there's no translation that happens. It could be a mess. It's just a good reminder. JJ, this has been awesome. The last question I have, I like to ask all my guests, is just if you could go back 5, 10, 15 years in time, what advice would you give your younger self?
Oh, man, that is really a good one. I think about that all the time. I think about, number one, if I could go back, I wouldn't. You know, who I am today, both good and bad, are built on those experiences. It's much like the butterfly effect. I could go back, make a big enough change, and my children would never be here, which are the most important things in my life. Advice for an earlier self is keep investing. And I don't mean just financially. I was very fortunate enough that I did invest early on in my career and did very well. But keep investing in everything about you. Invest in your health. Invest in your education. Invest in your ability to learn and keep learning, investing your future. It's all part of it, right? Investing your mental health, invest every dollar you put into yourself. And I don't mean buying sneakers. Every dollar you invest in yourself is exponentially paid out. And it could be every dollar you put back in your 401k, every dollar you put back in, learning modules, every dollar you put back in going to the gym, all of it has incredible return on investment. Because you focused on you.
Boom. Love it. JJ, this was awesome. Thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you, David.
And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in, and we will catch you all next week.
Thank you for listening to the Disruptive Innovators Champions of Digital Business podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review and subscribe to enjoy future episodes. This episode is brought to you by Disruptive Innovations, a leading tech consulting firm that helps enterprise organizations with their IT strategy, process optimization, and workflow improvement. Contact them and find out more at disruptiveinnovations.net.